This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Alma Midwifery provides relationship-based care with certified nurse and professional midwives, as well as childbirth education, yoga, and parenting classes, located in the heart of Portland at Southeast 16th and Ankeny, or almamidwifery.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Why, even as medicine improves, are we becoming less healthy? Why are American women dying in childbirth more now than 10 years ago? Why do we grow fatter the more we diet? Why have so many attempts to save the environment backfired? These are some of the questions that journalist Nathaniel Johnson explores in his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. Nathaniel Johnson is an award-winning journalist who has written features for Harper's, New York, and Outside Magazine, and produced stories for National Public Radio and This American Life. He studied with Michael Pollan at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He's here today on Health Watch and also at Powell's on Hawthorne on Thursday night. Welcome to Health Watch, Nathaniel Johnson.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Well, let's start with we mentioned all these conundrums that are in All Natural, and you sort of frame the conundrums around a tension that exists between nature and technology, and trying to parse out what would be an evidence-based or reasonable approach to various difficult questions. Could you articulate that nature-technology issue for you?
Sure. I mean, for me, this idea that what's natural is healthier. I have a lot of sympathy for this idea, and it goes back to my family. I grew up in this family that, you know, there's a lot of kale, there was a lot of brown rice in this family, and it was a really lovely childhood. And yet at the same time, there are ways that nature is fundamentally dangerous. And living in this family, I had a front row seat to see the ways in which trusting in nature sometimes backfired. And so I really wanted to start looking at where the natural really was healthier and where the technological was really healthier.
So the upsides and downsides of both, or
exactly,
taking one of them too far or not far enough.
Exactly. And I think there's our examples on both sides, where you can go too far in either direction.
Well, one of the most compelling parts of the book for me was about childbirth, and you were struggling with these questions yourself. Your wife was pregnant when you were writing this, and you're trying to figure out, well, what do I want to do? And I know a lot of people listening either have gone through this or are going through. There's so many choices. There isn't one sort of tradition anymore of how to do childbirth. And, you know, like we have our underwriter, Alma Midwifery, and people who are obsessed with Downton Abbey with stuff that was happening lately, and I won't do any spoilers. But it was fascinating to read this section because you were talking about statistics, about how the invention of C-section is one of the main reasons why we have such a reduction in infant mortality in the last 100 years. But at the same time, maternal death rates have gone up quite a bit in the last 20 or 30 years, and that is also because of C-section.
Right.
So
the double-edged sword.
So tell us both.
Double-edged scalpel, maybe.
Right. So tell us the story of C-section, and the upside. You know, is the technological upside of what it accomplished, and then tell us the downside of why C-section is now actually causing a problem and for certain people.
Right. So let me just preface it by saying I went into this with very little knowledge, and I just started doing my journalistic thing and calling every expert I know and moving who else is working on this, and eventually working my way through this, you know, making those 200 phone calls. So this expertise comes from others. I'm approaching this as a journalist. But what I found was that there's situations where the C-section is really life-saving, you know, placenta previa, where the placenta grows over the opening, so the baby can't go through, and there would be this tremendous bleed if there weren't some technological workaround. There are a lot of these cases where in the past, when C-sections were really dangerous, it would almost be certain death for the mother and sometimes the baby as well. And so it's this very simple, very efficient technology, and it's so easy and safe in the moment of birth that we've kind of let it get away from us. And because it's so simple and so efficient, some people have sort of said, well, let's just replace this inefficient technology of birth itself with the C-section. And so we've gotten to this strange situation where about one third of all births now are happening via cesarean section. And one of the first things that I found when I started making these phone calls that really blew me out of the water was that the maternal mortality rate, at least in California, is going up. And it looks like that's the case around the country as well. And
you had the statistic that it had doubled since 1998, which is a pretty remarkable increase.
Yeah. I mean, we're still talking about small numbers here, fortunately, of actual deaths. But those deaths are just the tip of the iceberg for this whole host of problems, severe maternal injuries, women having heart attacks during birth. That's gone up 80% in the last decade. So all of these things, and these things affect many more women than the handful that actually die. And there is a portion of this that's definitively linked to the increase in cesarean sections. So people are starting to work on this. Unfortunately, a lot of the answers that the mainstream health system brings to this are reactive answers. Let's train our doctors to respond faster than ever to hemorrhages, that type of stuff, which is great. But if you step back and look at the big picture, people are also starting to say, maybe we should just see if we can reduce the number of C-sections that we're doing.
Well, I mean, the statistics are amazing. So, you know, prior to the 80s, you have the statistic that at the turn of the century, between 600 and 900 women would die in childbirth for every 100,000 births, and that C-section and other interventions have lowered that from 600 to 900 down to 8.
Right.
But now that it's going up again, in all natural, you say that it actually would be safer to give birth in 1978 than now, which is such an interesting thing to think about, and so counter to all of the sort of trust we put into this idea of inexorable medical progress.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the ruling ideology of America, right? We make progress, we invent new things, we move forward, things get better every day, and yes, this is one example. And I stumbled across a few of these paradoxes where our attempts to make life better are actually making it worse in some ways.
Well, another thing that you mentioned in the book is an assessment of different practices of medicine and how much of what they do is based on evidence,
right,
versus just a tradition that's passed down without an examination of the tradition. And obstetrics ended last. In other words,
out of all the specialties.
Yeah, yeah. And so in other words, it's the specialty that had the least amount of data to support most of its choices. Can you talk about some of the other maybe less crucial for life or death issues that happen all the time in obstetrics, but really don't really have any basis for them one way or the other, as far as we know?
Well, the big one is fetal heart monitors. This is a technology that, again, intuitively just makes so much sense. You want to pay attention to what's going on with the fetus. We can't see it, and so that makes people really nervous. So let's listen to the heart and see if there's anything wrong. But when they actually did the randomized controlled trials on this, they found that it was really useful for women that had dangerous pregnancies, the high-risk situations. But for normal low-risk situations, it didn't improve outcomes at all. And in fact, it actually led to more cesarean sections because there were false alarms. And yet, despite this evidence, it's really hard for hospitals and doctors to let go of them because that's the paradigm. It makes sense that this technology, seeing more, gives you more certainty. At least it seems that way, and it's very hard for us to accept that it might not be that way.
Is that true also with ultrasounds, or are ultrasounds in a different category in terms of that? Because I know that's something that's not, that's just routine now at this point, right?
Well, the thing with ultrasounds, I think you can make a parallel. Ultrasounds don't actually improve the rate of survival. It makes sense, again, you want to go in and look and see if there's anything wrong with the baby. But what they're really useful for is being able to make that decision if you want to end the pregnancy. If there's something really wrong, then people have abortions sometimes. And they're not actually useful for improving the health if you weren't going to make that decision. And so, again, that's I think that that's a good technology, but people should be having that discussion ahead of time and really realizing what's at stake, rather than this is something that we all are going to do and then have to deal with the consequences later if they should come up.
We're talking today with journalist and author Nathaniel Johnson about his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Helps Us, really keeps us healthier and happier.
The subtitle's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, but it's an interesting one. So let's switch to another topic. I mean, another one is the hygiene hypothesis. And of course, at some point in this century or the last century, we thought that all bacteria was bad.
Right.
And now we know that it's much more complicated. And you go both into the role of breast milk and also sort of this debate around raw milk and pasteurization. So tease our listeners a little bit about the dilemma there, because some of them are going, really? There's a dilemma around around raw milk and pasteurization?
Yeah. So to do this, I told this story of this farmer up in Canada who's this biodynamic German farmer who has this beautiful farm, and he produces raw milk for this little community of Waldorf school parents and immigrants, interestingly. A lot of the people that want raw milk are people who grew up drinking it and want their kids to have the same lifestyle. And his he understands that when you produce raw milk, you are taking a risk, that you're not killing everything in it, you're not sterilizing it. So sometimes dangerous bacteria could get in there, but you're also working with an ecosystem instead. So if his idea is that if you can work with nature and create a healthy ecosystem on the farm, then you create a healthy ecosystem in the milk, and ultimately a healthy ecosystem in the people that are drinking the milk. And there was a really fascinating for me story where he got busted because this is illegal in Ontario where he is. And right after that, he was out in the field with his cows, and the bull charged him and gored him into the earth and just, you know, almost killed him. And I asked him, after this happened, didn't this kind of make you reappraise, you know, trusting in nature? Here's this bull that you've left the horns on because you wanted it to be more natural, and it's just almost done you in. And he said something like, you know, nature is dangerous, yes, but I can't control it. I have to accept that. I can only work with it and do my best. And so this is kind of the dilemma.
And on his side of the ledger is some research that if we limit our exposure to bacteria too much, that can actually lead to certain diseases.
Yeah, this research is actually really strong. There's the literature is mountainous. It keeps on growing. And we're seeing this rise, this tidal wave in autoimmune disorders, asthma, allergies, eczema, more dangerous autoimmune disorders like type 1 diabetes. And you can see this in your own community, I'm sure, if you look around and look at kids these days versus 20 or 30 years ago, the rates of allergies have really skyrocketed. And we think that the hygiene hypothesis is that this is related to this wall of sanitation that we've erected around ourselves, and we've alienated our microbial frenemies, I call them, that can sometimes do us harm, but also were incorporated into our bodies during evolution. We evolved in this microbial soup, and so some of these, our immune systems expect to be there and go a little haywire when they're not there. And the studies that have looked tried to pin down which one of these bacteria are essential. It's really hard to do because I think we're talking about an ecosystem rather than one little. They'd like to find one little thing and bottle it and sell it to all of us. But what they've really found is that kids growing up on farms are protected against these autoimmune disorders. And there does seem to be something about milk that's heat labile, that's destroyed by pasteurization, that's protective as well. We don't know what. It's not a huge effect. But it's interesting.
Well, let me ask you a question about that and the research there. I looked at a couple of the larger raw milk studies, which do show that correlation. But when you looked at the data more closely, you also saw that a lot of the people were boiling their milk. Up to half of the people in some of the studies were boiling just on their own, and it wasn't controlled for. Is there a difference between boiling and pasteurization where something about, you know, someone just putting it on their stovetop and boiling it for 10 minutes is qualitatively different than pasteurizing it? Do you know?
No. Boiling it would be much more severe, actually, than pasteurizing it. I mean, pasteurizing it's just for, I think, 30 seconds, heating it up, and not even quite to boiling. So,
okay.
So that, you know, if they're boiling it on the stove, they're still getting the effect, they're getting it from the animals, or not from the milk itself.
Well, I mean, the other question might be also, like, are the animals grass-fed,
right,
pastured animals versus grain-fed animals, which could also play a role in immune modulation, I
absolutely
would guess.
Absolutely. Is that the von Mutius study that you were
I don't remember. I just remember there were two that were relatively large, thousands,
yeah,
of people. And I remember when I actually started looking at not the results that you saw in the media, but at the actual details,
yeah,
that they commented in the discussion section about how many of the people were boiling. It wasn't everybody. It
right.
was, I think it was less than half, but it was a sizable minority.
That's a detail that I'd miss. So,
yeah.
So go on.
Well, another thing that seemed interesting on the milk component is the studies around the role of breast milk. And at one point we thought breast milk was only to protect us from bacteria, but it looks like it might actually facilitate us having bacteria grow,
yeah,
in our bodies. So
yeah.
can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this is a fascinating area of study. And there's this guy named Bruce German working at UC Davis, a food chemist at UC Davis, who turned me on to this. And he became interested because he started finding, well, they had found already that there were these strange sugars in milk called oligosaccharides, very complex, weird sugars. And babies can't digest these sugars. And he started thinking, well, milk comes from the mother's body. She's literally breaking down her tissues to create this. And so if she was creating something that didn't help the baby, evolution would weed that out. So what is it about this strange sugar that the baby can't seem to derive any nutrients from that's so beneficial that she goes to all this trouble to build it? And they started trying to feed it to these different bacteria, and they found these very specific bacteria, specifically Bifidobacteria infantis, just thrived on this stuff. And it has this very unique genome. It's really evolved with us. And so he says, you know, this is an organism that the mother has recruited to babysit, essentially, and give this baby a good start with its gut ecology. And we don't know yet, you know, if that bacteria starts in the breast itself, or if it starts in the mouth, but at some point it gets in there and then starts thriving.
We're talking today with journalist and author Nathaniel Johnson about All Natural, and Nathaniel, you're going to be at Hawthorne Powell's on Thursday. So since this is such a fun read, also not just an informative one, but you share a lot of family anecdotes and interweave them into the narrative. Let's give our listeners a little taste of the prose. Get
Great.
Them to the bookstore on Thursday.
All right. Yes, it's a mix of memoir and science writing. And so this is the moment that I kind of fell from grace, 5 years old, and I realized that my family, our beliefs about nature might not be absolute, that we might be wrong. And we just moved up to a small town and had gone to this potluck. It was a warm summer evening. Casseroles and salads were spread out along the table by the water. Adults batted at mosquitoes. Children ran up and down the lakeshore in screaming waves. On a platform floating offshore, kids were playing King of the Hill, forming alliances, betraying them, and splashing into the water in glorious defeat. Lake Vera is a miserable little algae farm, but at that moment it looked marvelous. I stripped down and crashed through the shallows, my pudgy little brother hard at my heels. When I reached the platform, I flopped aboard, then pivoted, bracing myself to take all comers. Instead of rushing me, everyone stopped. It was only at that moment that I noticed, in stark contrast to me, every other child was wearing a swimsuit. We've all experienced what I experienced next. You show up at school or at work and realize two things in quick succession. First, that you are naked, and second, that this is highly, excruciatingly inappropriate. The difference is that most people undergo this trial while dreaming. I got to live the dream. Nakedness had always been part of our household. And so this is the first moment that I realized that the ideals that my parents had held to be self-evident, others thought completely weird.
Sure. That's great. Great and horrifying for you at the time.
Poor little five-year-old Nate.
That's right. Let's do a little touch on the topic. You have a chapter on when medicine isn't the best medicine. So,
right.
I mean, that's something that's really big in the news now. It was big a little while ago about prostate screening, and
yes.
Now it's really big about mammograms, where sometimes the things, and this is probably goes back also to fetal heart monitoring and
exactly.
Ultrasounds, that sometimes these things that seem like they're really calming and reassuring us might actually be leading to more and unnecessary medical interventions.
Yeah. You know, the dominant storyline with medicine is always more, right? More is better. More health care. How can more care be bad? But there's a lot of evidence that we're overtreated. And in fact, the numbers are pretty clear that more Americans are killed by too much medicine than are killed because they don't have access to medicine. And so I think that we've got to be really careful in terms of blindly accepting more when it comes to our healthcare.
That's a really good point, and one that's so counterintuitive for people, I think.
Exactly. Absolutely. You know, it's so amazing. The things that we can do now are really mind-boggling, and we should give modern medicine credit for that. But there's a tendency to think that it can perform miracles and that it can provide us certainty and keep us in the end from dying. Even if we don't think that consciously, there's this urge to believe that, I think.
Well, it's interesting. That's the whole conundrum of evidence-based medicine. I think when I've looked at reviews of like the British Medical Journal or other places that have tried to assess how much of what we do is proven, and if it's hard because some of the things you don't want to do double-blind placebo studies of restarting someone's heart when they have a heart
yeah.
attack, right? Because that's not going to work ethically. But I think it's somewhere around 30 to 50% has gone through the most rigorous double-blind placebo studies that we do. So, and then there's another 30% with compelling evidence, but that compelling evidence is a shifting milestone where
right.
30 years later, you know, hormone replacement therapy is not good for you, and it was good for everything before.
Right, yes, and it's really tricky for patients especially to navigate. You know, the people who are versed in the healthcare system can understand these things a little bit, but it's really hard to go in and the doctor recommends that you get this prostate PSA test or a mammogram. It's really hard sometimes to pin the doctor down and make sure that they give you the 30 minutes to really talk through what are the benefits to this? What are the risks? What are the alternatives? What happens if we just do this later rather than now?
Right, and even around the downsides of pharmaceutical medications, it's very rare that your doctor will say, this could happen to 1% of people who take this for 5 years, for instance.
Right. Yeah, And I think that there's, you know, there's this whole movement now of shared decision making, which tries to get at this problem where, you know, we have these kind of algorithms to match. Here you have this disease, so this is the pharmaceutical that we're going to throw you on. And that makes a lot of sense from, you know, our shifting level of evidence. Whatever the evidence says, that's what we'll go with, and then we'll replace it when the evidence contradicts that. But it doesn't make so much sense necessarily for the individual unique patient. And so this shared decision-making is really this process of forcing that, trying to make that conversation happen between the doctor and the patient so that it's really both right for the individual patient and for the best evidence that we have.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of time to go into the vaccine section, which I think for our listeners will probably be the most provocative section. But I love the fact that you grapple with the information around vaccines and actually come up with the feeling that they're in a way more on the natural side than on the technological side. Could you just maybe tease our listeners about that a little? And
yeah,
maybe people want to hear more when they come to Powell's.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just want to preface it by saying it's such a divisive issue that I'm really humble about it. And I'm totally open to more evidence. And I think the big problem is that there's been this polarization and people aren't willing to talk to each other about it. So I continue looking. But when I went out and looked at the evidence with an open mind, I kind of became convinced that vaccines were natural, you know, and this barrier of sterility that we've erected between ourselves and the microbial soup that we evolved in, vaccines do something to bridge that barrier. They reconnect us with our old microbial friends. It's a form of communion with the natural world in a way, because we used to have this exposure to the cows and the cowpox and this some protection from the smallpox. Now we have the same thing through these vaccines.
That's really interesting. And with the vaccines and the data, you also, in All Natural, you look at the incidence of the side effects, because obviously all vaccines have risks and
Absolutely.
Side effects. And you look at the head-to-head between the risks of the disease versus the risks of the vaccine itself.
Right, exactly. And that information is out there. And when you look at the risks of the vaccines, they've gotten so good. They've gotten so much better and so much less reactive that it's, for a lot of them, it's like the risk of walking outside your door and getting shot by a drive-by or something. They're just extremely low risks. And when for me at least, when I weigh that against the risks of getting the disease and getting harm from that, it looks like a good deal.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, Nathaniel.
Oh, it's so much fun to be here.
So we're talking today with journalist and author Nathaniel Johnson about his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. If you're interested in hearing more of Nathaniel, he's going to be at the Powell's Hawthorne on Thursday night. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor Threshold, Black Water Snake, a benefit for the Oregon Acupuncture and Naturopathic Associations. Saturday, February 9th, from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., will be a Chinese New Year party, and Sunday, February 10th, from 6 to 10 p.m., will be a benefit auction fundraiser. Both events will be held at Refuge PDX, 116 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. The Black Water Snake is intuitive, a socially adventurous spirit that loves taking risks. The theme encourages discovery of balance in the feminine and masculine energies within ourselves, our relationships, our communities, and the world at large. More information can be found at kbu.fm/threshold2013.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio, Megan Buisson.
Hello, Will. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, now that is really quite an accomplishment. You're the world record holder in inline speed skating. That's like rollerblading. Like, you're the fastest rollerblader in the world. Is that right?
Yes, technically, at that distance.
And what was the distance? Like, a number of meters? There's a category, and you're the fastest in that category. Is that how it is?
Yep, it's the world record. So it was 26.2 miles, 42 kilometers, and I did it in 77 minutes.
That's really extraordinary. It's great to have you on the show. And your excelling as an athlete, as a world-class athlete, is also really connected to your recovery story and a really remarkable journey that you've been on, fighting your way through multiple psychiatric diagnoses and being on multiple medications, as well as struggling with eating disorders and self-harm. And so can you just tell us how did this really, when was it that the eating disorders and problems with self-harm really emerged? Was that in your childhood?
The short answer was I became anorexic when I was 13, which is when I started self-harming as well. The longer answer is it dated back likely before then. I grew up very much with the belief that failure was not an option and I was not good enough.
This was the culture in your family. Your family is very strong perfectionist and no failure kind of family.
A great, great family. But yeah, I was the youngest of three girls and we were all very good at school and very involved in sports. And my parents worked very, very hard to raise us well. And in some ways they did a really great job. For me, being quite sensitive, when things were rocky at home, I dealt with it by shutting down and disappearing, quite literally, physically with anorexia, and then emotionally, I became aphasic, connected being loved to not being a bother. And so I became the perfect